KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
From New York, this is Democracy Now.
I think you have to do it because they're very dishonest. You need a fair press, and the press says, no, I see others. I have a few others that I'm doing. I'm doing this not because I want to. I'm doing this because I feel I have an obligation.
As a constitutional crisis looms in Washington, we look at President Trump's escalating war on the press as he ups his lawsuit against CBS to $20 billion. We'll speak to Jamil Jaffer, the head of the Knight First Amendment Institute at Columbia University. Then to Guantanamo. The Center for Constitutional Rights has preemptively blocked the Trump administration from sending three detained Venezuelan migrants to the U.S. Navy base in Cuba. Then the acclaimed Palestinian author and poet, Mohammed El-Kurd. His new book is out today, Perfect Victims and the Politics of Appeal.
People need to understand that the root cause of all of the violence in Palestine is not inexplainable or complicated. It's simply stated Zionism, an ethno-nationalist supremacist ideology of expansion and discrimination and dispossession, and it must be opposed.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The ceasefire agreement between Hamas and Israel that would lead to the release of captives on both sides is now on the brink of collapse after Hamas said Israel repeatedly violated the agreement. Hamas cited recently deadly attacks by Israel, including four Palestinians killed over the weekend, as well as large shortfalls in the number of humanitarian aid and fuel trucks allowed to enter Gaza. Palestinians say Israel's barred all but 20,000 of the 200,000 tents that it agreed to send and has entirely failed in its commitment to allow 60,000 mobile homes in Gaza. On Monday, President Trump said the ceasefire deal should be canceled unless Hamas releases all the remaining hostages by Saturday, repeating his threat that all hell is going to break out in Gaza. Palestinians reacted to Trump's threat.
Donald Trump, the U.S. president, says that if Hamas does not provide us with the hostages on time, Gaza will become hell. What hell? Hell worse than what we already have? Hell worse than killing, the destruction, all the practices and inhumane crimes that have occurred in the Gaza Strip have not happened anywhere else in the world.
Most of Gaza remains without running water or reliable power. And most families lack basic services like sanitation and health care. This week, heavy rain and strong winds have left hundreds of thousands of people living in makeshift tents exposed to the severe cold and wet conditions. Meanwhile, President Trump has said Palestinians will have no right of return to Gaza under his plan to expel the territory's entire Palestinian population and for the U.S. to own Gaza. Trump spoke to Fox News' Brett Baer.
We'll build beautiful communities for the 1.9 million people. We'll build beautiful communities, safe communities. Could be five, six, could be two. But we'll build safe communities a little bit away from where they are, where all of this danger is. In the meantime, I would own this. Think of it as a real estate development for the future. It would be a beautiful piece of land.
Would the Palestinians
no
have the right
money
to return?
Spent. No, they wouldn't, because they're going to have much better housing.
President Trump's meeting with Jordan's King Abdullah at the White House today. Ahead of the meeting, Trump threatened to cut off U.S. aid to Jordan and to Egypt unless the two countries agree to take in the more than 2 million Palestinians Trump is seeking to permanently expel from Gaza. Both Egypt and Jordan have rejected Trump's idea, which has drawn scorn and condemnation across the Arab world and from world leaders. This week, more than 110 U.S. organizations said they're deeply alarmed by Trump's recent statements. The NGOs wrote in a joint public letter, quote, "Palestine is not just an idea, it's a place. It's a homeland to the Palestinian people." to participate in, facilitate, or endorse their removal from it would violate every precept of international law, devastate the rules-based international order that protects us all, do irreversible harm to America's global influence, and be an act of unconscionable immorality, they wrote. In the occupied West Bank, Israeli forces raided the educational bookshop, a beloved cultural hub in East Jerusalem that was established more than four decades ago. Israeli soldiers detained Palestinian owners Ahmed and Mahmoud Muna and seized hundreds of books on Palestine, including an English language coloring book for children titled From the River to the Sea and Gaza in Crisis by Noam Chomsky and the Israeli scholar Ilan Pappe. We'll have more on this later in the broadcast with the acclaimed Palestinian poet and journalist Mohammed Okurb. The Trump administration's pushed the United States deeper into a constitutional crisis after a federal judge in Rhode Island said the White House ignored his previous order halting Trump's sweeping federal funding freeze. U.S. District Judge John McConnell ruled Monday the Trump administration continues to violate his clear and unambiguous January 29th ruling to keep federal funds flowing. The New York Times reports it's the first time a judge has expressly declared the Trump administration is disobeying a judicial mandate. Attorneys general from 22 states warned in a court filing Friday that Trump's refusal to heed the judge's order continues to cause immediate and irreparable harm, jeopardizing, quote, jobs, lives, and the social fabric of life, unquote. In Washington, D.C., hundreds of protesters rallied outside the offices of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau Monday after the Trump administration moved to shut down the agency's headquarters and cut off its funding. Democratic Senator Elizabeth Warren, credited with creating the CFPB, slammed Elon Musk's Doge operation and the Office of Management and Budget's director, Russell Vogt, saying their attempt to shutter the CFPB is, quote, the payoff to the rich guys.
This fight is about more than just our financial rules and regulations. This fight is about more than just Democrat versus Republican politics. This fight is about hardworking people versus the billionaires who want to squeeze more and more and more money out of them.
A federal judge has indefinitely extended the deadline for government workers to accept a government buyout issued by Elon Musk's Doge operation, offering 8 months of pay and benefits to anyone taking an early retirement. Unions representing hundreds of thousands of government workers celebrated the extension as a temporary victory, while legal challenges to the buyout offer proceed in court. President Trump signed an executive order Monday directing the Department of Justice to stop enforcing the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act of 1977, which bars U.S. citizens from bribing foreign government officials to win business. Separately, Trump fired the head of the Office of Government Ethics Monday. David Huitema was nominated by President Biden and confirmed last November by the Senate before Trump fired him just weeks into his five-year tenure. Meanwhile, the head of the independent federal agency that protects whistleblowers, Hampton Dellinger, filed a lawsuit Monday challenging his dismissal from the U.S. Office of Special Counsel by President Trump. The Project on Government Oversight called it an illegal firing that, quote, undermines the office that investigates whistleblower disclosures of wrongdoing and enforces the law meant to keep partisan politics out of the federal workforce, unquote. On Monday, a federal court issued a stay allowing Dellinger to keep his job for at least a few days longer while the court considers his lawsuit. A third federal judge has blocked President Trump's executive order seeking to end birthright citizenship for children of undocumented immigrants living in the U.S. There are at least nine lawsuits challenging Trump's order, including one by the ACLU. In related news, Trump's Homeland Security Department is looking to deputize officials with the Internal Revenue Service's criminal unit and other Treasury Department personnel to assist in federal immigration enforcement. The U.S. Justice Department has directed Manhattan prosecutors to drop corruption charges against New York City Mayor Eric Adams. Emile Bove, Trump's acting deputy attorney general, wrote that the DOJ decided to interfere because the indictment against Adams created a hurdle in Adams' ability to carry out Trump's crackdown on immigrant communities. The DOJ is calling for the charges to be dropped without prejudice, meaning they can be revived at any point. The order came on the same day Adams reportedly ordered his staff not to publicly criticize Trump and not to intervene with federal immigration enforcement. This comes amidst mounting confusion and mixed messages from the Adams administration over how workers should respond to ICE if they show up at city buildings like schools and hospitals. Last month, Mayor Adams traveled to Palm Beach personally to meet with Trump in Mar-a-Lago and attended his inauguration. Queens Assembly member, New York City mayoral candidate Sohrab Mamdani said, quote, in the midst of a right-wing billionaire assault on the working class of our city, Eric Adams sold us out for another personal favor, Mamdani said. On Monday, Trump pardoned former Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich, who in 2011 was convicted and jailed for attempting to sell Barack Obama's U.S. Senate seat. Blagojevich's prison term was cut short in 2020 when Trump commuted his sentence during his first presidency. The U.S. Senate voted Monday to advance Tulsi Gabbard's nomination to become Director of National Intelligence. Many Democrats have opposed Gabbard's nomination over her 2017 meeting with Syria's then-leader Bashar al-Assad and past comments blaming NATO for Russia's war in Ukraine. This is California Senator Adam Schiff speaking on the Senate floor Monday.
She can apologize for Assad or Putin or any other murderous dictator to her heart's content. But we're not considering Ms. Gabbard for some position in which her bizarre fondness for foreign despots is beside the point. She is not the nominee for Postmaster General. We're considering her for one of the most important jobs in our intelligence community. And for that, Tulsi Gabbard is a walking five-alarm fire and must be rejected.
During her Senate confirmation hearing, Tulsi Gabbard repeatedly refused to call Edward Snowden a traitor. Sam Altman, the CEO and co-founder of OpenAI, said his company is not for sale after Elon Musk and his investors on Monday offered to buy OpenAI's for-profit assets for $97.4 billion. Altman responded to the bid by posting on X, "No thank you, but we will buy Twitter for $9.74 billion if you want." Altman has been attempting to disentangle OpenAI, which developed ChatGPT, from its nonprofit status and board. OpenAI was co-founded by Musk in 2015, but he left in 2019. Vice President J.D. Vance, who's in Paris for the AI Action Summit, as is Sam Altman, warned other countries against regulating U.S. tech and blasted the European Union's ongoing efforts to regulate AI, social media, and tech monopolies. And the Pentagon has ordered an immediate ban on transgender military recruits and halted all gender-affirming medical procedures for active-duty military. Legal groups, including Human Rights Campaign, have filed lawsuits against Trump's anti-trans EO on behalf of military members. On Friday, the Education Department ordered an end to programs that support transgender students. Here in New York, trans youth and their allies held a massive rally in Union Square to defend trans rights amidst recent moves by local hospitals to halt gender-affirming care. This is 14-year-old Nero.
As a pre-existing NYU Langone patient, the recent events concerning NYU and the orange in office is really upsetting. I'm not directly as affected as others who have recently have been denied health care. This is pure discrimination. This is offensive. This should not be allowed. And I want to finish by saying that we as a community will not stop fighting this fight.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Mimi Goodman in New York, joined by Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
As a constitutional crisis grows in Washington, we begin today's show looking at the Trump administration's escalating attacks on press freedom. Last week, the interim U.S. attorney in Washington, Edward Martin, threatened to prosecute anyone, including journalists, who, quote, target or, quote, impede Elon Musk, and Doge. That's the Department of Government Efficiency. Martin's letter came a day after Musk claimed it was a crime to identify the young computer engineers who've helped him gain access to highly sensitive information at agencies across Washington. Meanwhile, the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission, has opened an investigation into San Francisco-based KCBS over the radio station's reporting on recent immigration raids. The FCC has also opened a broader investigation of NPR and PBS and their practice of airing underwriting announcements. On Friday, Donald Trump openly called for the Washington Post to fire longtime columnist Eugene Robinson after he accused Trump of trampling the Constitution. Meanwhile, a number of major news organizations face accusations of already bending a knee to Trump. In December, ABC settled a defamation suit brought by Trump by making a $15 million donation to his future presidential library. CBS's parent company, Paramount Global, is reportedly in talks to settle a multi-billion dollar lawsuit filed by Trump, who accused 60 Minutes of deceptively editing an interview with Kamala Harris. Trump initially sought $10 billion in the lawsuit, but he's upped it now to $20 billion. Last week, CBS took the unusual step of handing over its unedited tapes to the FCC. While the tapes showed no wrongdoing on CBS's part, many believe Paramount might still settle the lawsuit. This all is happening as Paramount seeks federal approval for its $8 billion merger with Skydance Media. We're joined right now by Jamil Jaffer, executive director of the Knight First Amendment Institute at Columbia University. His recent New York Times opinion piece is headlined, "This is not a moment to settle with Trump." Welcome back to Democracy Now!, Jamil.
Thanks, Amy.
So we just went through some of the cases, but if you can go through them in depth and explain what is happening here. Is the media obeying in advance?
Yeah, I mean, that's how I see it. I see a kind of failure of courage among the largest and most powerful media organizations in the country. You know, you started with the ABC settlement. This is a case that arose out of George Stephanopoulos saying on TV that President Trump had been found liable for rape, when in fact the jury had found him liable for sexual assault. Trump sued, claiming that he'd been defamed. I don't think that there.
And let's be clear, it was the judge who said, in common parlance, this would be rape.
That's right. That's right. I don't think that Trump had any chance of winning that lawsuit. If ABC had contested it, ABC would have been protected by the New York Times versus Sullivan rule. New York Times versus Sullivan is a 60-year-old case that gives citizens broad power to. Or broad latitude to criticize government officials, makes it very difficult for public officials to recover in defamation actions. I don't think there's any way that ABC would have lost that case, but they settled the case. Second one is Meta's settlement with Trump. This is over Meta's decision, or Facebook and Instagram's decision, to deplatform Trump after January 6th. Trump sued, claiming that his First Amendment rights had been violated. This, I think, is a totally frivolous case. There's no way that Trump would have won that case against Meta, but Meta settled it as well for $25 million. Again, all going to Trump's presidential library. And then finally, this reported CBS settlement, or possible CBS settlement, with Trump over the action, you know, over the case that involved the editing of this Kamala Harris interview. I don't think that CBS edited that interview in any unusual way at all. The kind of editing they did is routine for journalism, for media organizations. Trump knows that. Again, no chance that Trump would have won that case, but CBS is reportedly thinking about settling it. So what I see here is media organizations that have the power to fight back against Trump but aren't doing it. I think that's a failure of courage, and it has implications for those particular media organizations, because I think it affects their credibility and their prestige. But it has larger press freedom implications as well, because every time one of those media organizations settles a case, the next organization finds it more difficult to resist Trump. And this is a moment in which we need these organizations to hold the powerful to account, hold Trump to account, and this is exactly what they should not be doing.
And Jamil, what about this latest story this week about the FCC investigating a San Francisco radio station, KCBS, for its coverage of immigration enforcement in San Jose?
Yeah, I mean, here too, I think you see the Trump administration trying to use its regulatory authorities in a way that chills press freedom, chills legitimate reporting. No question here that that radio station was within its rights to report what it did. And what Trump is trying to do, or what the FCC is trying to do here, is chill not just that radio station, but other radio stations and other media organizations from engaging in reporting that is inconvenient to the administration. I mean, I mentioned the CBS case. You know, another aspect of that case involves the FCC, with the FCC having demanded from CBS that it turn over unedited transcripts of its interview with Kamala Harris. And I don't think in another...
And they released them.
I don't think in another, in any other era, a news organization would have just turned over those transcripts without at least trying to get a judge to narrow the request or look at the transcripts in camera before turning them over. But CBS just turned them over. I think that there's a real risk here that on paper we're going to have all the First Amendment rights in the world. The First Amendment is going to look great on paper, but the organizations that we need to assert their First Amendment rights to defend press freedom are increasingly just not doing it. I mean, I've named a few of the settlements, but even before we got to the settlements, there were the LA Times and the Washington Post, which quashed editorials that would have been that would have provoked Trump. This happened before the election. Then there were the big tech companies that all made $1 million donations to Trump's inaugural fund. I think what we're seeing is media organizations, including social media organizations, lining up to ingratiate themselves with President Trump. And that is an extremely troubling thing at this particular moment.
And of course, it's not just media organizations, universities. Talk about the free speech rights that are endangered, increasingly endangered at universities by the Trump administration, for instance, threatening to deport pro-Palestinian students.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is it's a larger issue across society. Many of the institutions that we need to serve as checks on government power at a moment like this are not doing their jobs. Now, this question about, in what circumstances can the government deport non-citizens for exercising their First Amendment rights, I think is a hugely significant question. And I want people to understand that the First Amendment protects non-citizen students at American universities just like it protects everybody else. The government cannot constitutionally deport people simply because they have exercised their First Amendment rights, simply because they have criticized a war overseas or criticized our government or criticized another government. Those are not constitutionally permissible justifications for deporting somebody. So you don't have to take my word for it, because a couple of years ago, the Knight Institute, my institute, filed a Freedom of Information Act request with the Biden administration, and we were able to get two legal memos, in which the Trump administration had considered its authority to engage in these kinds of deportations based on First Amendment activity. And Trump administration lawyers wrote memos that acknowledge that non-citizens at universities in the United States are protected by the First Amendment, and that deporting them on the basis of their speech would almost certainly be unconstitutional.
And then, Jamil Jaffer, talk about what happened Friday night with the casino magnate Steve Wynn asking the Supreme Court to revisit the Times versus Sullivan defamation rule, the Supreme Court decision, one of the two most important press freedom cases.
Yeah, so I mentioned New York Times versus Sullivan already. This is has been a campaign by some conservatives over the last few years to try to get the Supreme Court to narrow or overrule New York Times versus Sullivan, which would be a very big deal because it's New York Times versus Sullivan more than any other case that protects our ability to criticize government officials, which is core to our democracy.
And this, what was it established under, New York Times versus Sullivan? What case was that?
So it's called New York Times versus Sullivan. It's a case involving the New York Times was sued by a Southern police official who was concerned about civil rights activism in the South and complained in particular about an ad in the New York Times that he said accurately was inaccurate. The ad included some inaccuracies in it. And he said because the ad included inaccuracies, the New York Times was liable, I think it was for $500,000, which at the time would have been crushing liability even for the New York Times. And if he had won that case, other news organizations reporting on the civil rights movement would have been crushed as well. But the Supreme Court said, if you're criticizing government officials, you have to have broad latitude even to get things wrong. So unless the public official can show what's called actual malice, so and unless the public official can show that the newspaper or the writer recklessly published false information or deliberately published false information, there's no recovery possible. The First Amendment forecloses recovery. So now some conservatives are pushing to get the Supreme Court to overrule that decision. I think it's a misguided campaign, even, you know, if you want the things that these conservatives want. I think this is going to backfire on them. But this cert petition that was filed on Friday night, this request that the Supreme Court hear the case, is another effort in this longer campaign to get the Supreme Court to either scale back or overrule New York Times versus Sullivan.
Jamil Jaffer, thanks so much for being with us, director of the Knight First Amendment Institute at Columbia University. We'll link to your piece in the New York Times. This is not a moment to settle with Trump. Next up, Guantanamo. It was Super Bowl night when the Center for Constitutional Rights preemptively blocked the Trump administration from sending three detained Venezuelan migrants to the U.S. Navy base in Cuba. We'll talk about this and more in a moment. From Nothing by Billy Preston. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Juan, there are a lot of challenges right now in this country, but you've been looking at the kind of successful organizing that's going on with immigrant groups on the ground. Talk about what you see there in Chicago.
Yeah, Amy, well, you know, despite much media attention on the ramping up of mass deportations by the Trump administration, coverage, by the way, that the White House has aggressively orchestrated, the actual number of deportations during the first few weeks have hardly lived up to the hype. Homeland Security officials acknowledged yesterday that around 11,000 immigrants supposedly folks who have committed crimes or undocumented have been arrested, an average of about 500 a day. And just half of those, according to the department's own statistics, are supposedly criminals. Others are what they call collateral arrests. At that rate, it would take about 6 years just to deport 1 million people, not 10, not 5, 6, 7, or 11, just 1 million people would take 6 years. So obviously the worst is yet to come if we're to believe that Trump is actually serious about these deporting millions and millions of people. But few people are focusing on the inevitable resistance that immigrant rights groups are certain to launch. As we used to say in the 1960s, wherever there is oppression, there is resistance. And immigration activists that I've talked to in recent days are right now in the midst of coordinating a string of mass mobilizations for this spring that they hope will go beyond the historic immigrant rights protests of 2006, when millions and millions of undocumented and their supporters turned out into the streets of all the major cities in the United States. They're calling on grassroots organizations to culminate those protests in early May, specifically on May 1st, International Workers' Day, with a series of labor strikes, not just one, but several days without immigrants, including a Cinco de Mayo walkouts from restaurants and hotels across the country to make clear how critical immigrants are to American capitalism. So it's obvious that the neo-fascist coup we are witnessing will not be defeated by simply by legal challenges in the courts. It will have to be confronted in the streets. And I think that the immigrant rights groups are going to be setting the path for the level of militancy that will be needed.
Well, we're going to look right now at a victory for immigrant rights that came in a legal case on Sunday night, around the same time the musical legend John Batiste was singing the Star Spangled Banner at the start of the Super Bowl, attended by President Trump, just days after Trump fired Batiste and others from serving on the board of the JFK Center for Performing Arts. On Sunday evening, our next guest found himself on a video conference with federal judge Kenneth Gonzalez in New Mexico, as the judge temporarily blocked the U.S. government from sending his clients, three Venezuelan men, to the U.S. Navy base in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, where the Trump administration is preparing a 30,000-person detention center. Bahar Azmi is legal director of the Center for Constitutional Rights, which sought an emergency order to protect the three men who've been held for about a year at the Otero Detention Center for re-entering the United States. The men say they left Venezuela to request asylum in the U.S., but were rejected. When they saw others from the detention center transferred to Guantanamo, they feared they could be next, and asked the judge to preemptively block their transfer. Over the weekend, Secretary of Homeland Security Kristi Noem visited Guantanamo days after the first detained immigrants were flown there. She claimed without evidence on CNN that the people deported there were dangerous criminals.
These individuals are the worst of the worst that we pulled off of our streets.
Who are they?
Murderers, rapists. When I was there, I was able to watch one of the flights landing and them unload about 15 different of these criminals. Those were mainly child pedophiles, those that were out there trafficking children, trafficking drugs, and were pulled off of our streets and put at this facility.
This comes as the Trump administration recently withdrew temporary protected status for Venezuelans living here in the U.S. Bahar Azmi joins us now for more on this case filed with the American Civil Liberties Union of New Mexico, Las Américas Immigrant Advisory Center, its recent article for Slate. Well, we'll talk about that in a minute. So Sunday night, or more than 100 million people are watching the Super Bowl, but you're on a conference call. How did this happen?
Once our clients had some credible information that they might be transferred to Guantanamo, after all, they fit the profile of Venezuelans in detention in New Mexico, we decided we had to move and prevent their transfer, their rendition to the lawless space in Guantanamo. And our team from CCR and Las Americas and ACLU of New Mexico worked around the clock and filed an emergency motion Sunday, maybe at 5. And as I don't remember who was playing, within an hour, the judge asked for a conference call. Our team got on. He took it from the side of the road and agreed that there's too much of a risk to our ability to access our clients and to the court's jurisdiction to allow the government to transfer them. So he issued an order forbidding their transfer to Gitmo.
And could you talk about the challenges faced by immigration and human rights advocates in dealing with this Guantanamo situation, given the fact that there aren't even you don't even have the names of the people who are being shipped there?
Yeah, thanks, Juan. This is like a grim deja vu from 2001, early 2002, when the then lawless Guantanamo prison was populated by, as Noam repurposed, the worst of the worst. That was what was said about the Muslim men and boys who were sent there. And then, as now, had no idea the identities of people there, their legal status, or at least the administration's position regarding the legal status. And then, as of now, Guantanamo just represents this security theater. It's a kind of performative cruelty that, you know, stamps people simply by virtue of their placement there as dangerous. It's an utterly manufactured kind of performance to show muscularity through vengeance.
In addition to Bahar Azmi, legal director for the Center for Constitutional Rights, we're joined by Vince Warren, executive director of CCR. And Vince, I wanted to ask you about the constitutional crisis that is looming in this country. Many of Trump's executive orders have already been temporarily halted. Already a judge has said he is not obeying his order to start the funds flowing at the Treasury that have been approved by Congress. Yet you have Vice President J.D. Vance writing on X, that's the richest man in the world's platform, Elon Musk's platform. Vice President J.D. Vance said, judges aren't allowed to control the executive's legitimate power. Your response?
That is 100% not true. And we've been actually talking for many years about when does a constitutional crisis present itself. And I'm here to say that this is the moment. The question that we're all facing is that when courts issue legitimate orders to get the government to do things that it should do or to stop doing things that it shouldn't do or to comply with the law, and the administration says, yeah, we don't really have to comply with that. That's the definition of a constitutional crisis. And we're seeing that in that possibility in just about everything. In terms of the temporary restraining order that we got in Guantanamo, what's the guarantee that they're going to show up to court and with an adverse ruling stop transferring people? What's the guarantee that they're going to release the funds that courts order them to do? There is no guarantee precisely because this administration has been built on lies and the idea that it is actually that the law just doesn't apply to them. What applies to them are their political points. So we have a administration that is really moving to seize the pillars of our constitutional system and our laws and to rip them to shreds, not only just to test them, but to just destroy them. We are actually facing a constitutional crisis on a range of issues, and it's just not clear to any of us whether this administration will actually comply with the rule of law in any context.
And Vince, this use of Guantanamo Bay, not simply to as a detention center for or as a black hole prison for suspected terrorists, but Guantanamo was used even before that to house thousands of Haitians and Cubans who were trying to get to migrate into the United States. And interestingly, Rudy Giuliani was back then, before he was even mayor of New York, he was in the Justice Department involved in those. Are there any legal lessons from that prior period of using Guantanamo as a detention center for migrants?
Yeah, I think there are political lessons, Juan, and there are legal lessons. The political lesson is that for 40 years, dating back to the early 1990s, the United States government has used Guantanamo as a legal dumping ground for its political problems. Back then with the Haitians, you will recall that Haitians were sent there for suspected of having HIV and AIDS, and that was a health security crisis that the government said needed to happen. The Center for Constitutional Rights, Yale Law School, Harold Koh, Michael Ratner, successfully sued and got Haitian migrants released on that boundary, only to go maybe 10 12 years later, and they're opening Guantanamo now, the military side, for Guantanamo detainees, the story of the work that the Center for Constitutional Rights and Bahar Azmi is stuff of legend now. There are only 15 people left, but we were able to show, number one, that the people that were then described as the worst of the worst were not in fact so. There are only 15 men left in Guantanamo now, and as we are trying to make good on the failed promise of Barack Obama and Joe Biden to close that terrible facility, here comes Donald Trump, who now wants to open it up for yet another purpose. And he's using national security and the quote-unquote invasion of migrants as the emergency to reopen that base and to house people there for that purpose. I would say one thing that legally that we know that I think is significant here is that Trump himself has said that the reason why he's opening it up is because he doesn't trust the governments to take these people back. And if they take them back, that they're just going to re-release them. So that speaks to me of an indefinite detention regime, which is really, really problematic. The issue that we've been dealing with in Guantanamo, Kristi Noem, when she talked about it, as we just saw, she made no promises or guarantees as to what would happen. She largely said, well, it really depends on what Trump wants to do. That's how we're going to roll. There are potential violations of due process, the rights that these men have in this context, and we have not yet seen a situation where people are put in Guantanamo coming from the United States.
Before we go, Vince Warren, I want to ask you about Trump and the ICC. He's issued sanctions on the International Criminal Court over its investigations of Israeli officials for war crimes in Gaza. The chief prosecutor, Karim Khan, is their first target after arrest warrants were issued for Prime Minister Netanyahu and the former defense minister, Yoav Gallant, for war crimes and crimes against humanity. Can you lay out what you're calling this direct attack on the rule of law?
Absolutely. The Trump administration is saying once and for all, without any doubt, that they are siding with war criminals as opposed to the victims of war crimes. This is not a position that the United States should take, obviously. But I think what's more troubling is it's reopening the executive order that he had done previously, but it's now done in the context specifically of Israel and the United States. The executive order says specifically that because of what the ICC has done with respect to Netanyahu and Gallant, and because the U.S. has been targeted in ICC investigations, therefore the court is illegitimate. This is clearly an attempt to step away from the rule of law for the United States, and more importantly, to shield from any kind of liability or accountability people who are committing war crimes just because they're not signatories to the ICC. And we also know that the reason why they're not signatories to the ICC, because this is exactly the type of things that they were afraid of to begin with. So we're living outside of the law domestically. We're living outside of the law in terms of international human rights. And in every instance, it feels to me that we are siding for the unbridled power of the U.S. and Israel to do whatever the hell that they want, and that there's no court, this administration is saying, that can stop them.
Well, I want to thank you both for being with us. Vince Warren, Executive Director, Bahar Azmi, the Legal Director of the Center for Constitutional Rights. Next up, we'll be joined by the acclaimed Palestinian author and poet, Mohammed Al-Kurd. His new book is out today, Perfect Victims and the Politics of Appeal. Stay with us. It is evident, I do better win. I feel like the world against me and think I should never win. Can I stop it? Pocket profit every time I push a pin. But I do not push a pin for pin and the pin that imprison all my kin and my partners and my friends. The politicians that sponsor the prisons that they in. I got partners coming home from rocking 20 in the pen, trying to make amends with baby mamas, get to know they kin. And they cannot sell no marijuana, law won't let them in. Man, let her do, but will not let them in. It's evident, I do better win. I feel like the world against me and think I should never win. Can I stop it? Pocket profit every time I push a pin. But I do not push a pin. The pin and the pin that imprison all my kin and my partners and my friends. The politicians that sponsor the prisons that they in. That include the past, the former, current, and ex-president. You can quote it like I wrote it, signature by Michael Wynn. Swear to God that I go hard and that's as hard as MC Wynn. I don't need a reverend, I will not show reverence. Auntie say I'm arrogant, I say I'm intelligent. If God truly know my heart, then why would I bow to men? Now I only go to churches where they welcome worthless men. Who had to get out the mud and rise up out the sediment? Catch me early like Sunday school on this clinic.
with my dirty money. Talking, wash away my sins like Jesus opened the laundry.
Days by Killer Mike and Ty Dolla $ign. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We spend the rest of the hour with the acclaimed Palestinian writer, Mohammed Okurd. His new book is out today, Perfect Victims and the Politics of Appeal. The book's publication comes at a time when even books about Palestinians are seen as a threat to the Israeli state. On Sunday, Israeli police raided two locations of the educational bookshop, a beloved Palestinian-owned store in occupied East Jerusalem. Israel detained the bookstore owners, Mahmoud and his nephew, Ahmad Muna, who were held for two nights before being released earlier today. Ahmad spoke after his release.
We have just been released after 2 days of arrest. I have been released. Mahmoud is, we are waiting for his release. This arrest was brutal. The bases are not clear. We have been released today with conditions. We have to stay at home for 5 days of arrest, and we are not allowed in the shops for 20 days. It was a brutal, hard arrest, and it's obvious that there are no charges so far, so we are, there's nothing to be that we're held for.
Witnesses said the Israeli police used Google Translate during the raid to determine the names of books in Arabic. He said, quote, anything they didn't like, they took. Their reports books seized included children's coloring book titled From the River to the Sea and Noam Chomsky's book Gaza in Crisis, which he co-wrote with the Israeli scholar Ilan Pappe. Our guest, Mohammed Okurd, grew up in the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood of East Jerusalem, where Israel spent years trying to evict Palestinian families in order to give their homes to Jewish settlers. Mohammed Okurd, welcome back to Democracy Now! Congratulations on your new book. As you go around the country presenting Perfect Victims, you hear about this bookstore being closed and being the owners being arrested. Your thoughts and the significance of going after the books.
I mean, I think this is the attack on the educational bookstore in Jerusalem is yet another saga in the Israeli regime's scholasticide, the attack on culture, scholars. You know, we've seen them literally bomb every single university in the Gaza Strip. And this, the educational bookstore is, in fact, not the first bookstore in Jerusalem to be closed down, its owners arrested. So there is, you know, a criminalization of thought, a criminalization of the intellect, really. And we've seen this extend even to the realms of social media, where so many thousands of the people who have been arrested in the past 15 months have been arrested over Facebook posts. So the Israeli regime really is waging a war of consciousness against the Palestinian, the Palestinians' ability to express national sentiments. And we see this also here in the United States with President Trump saying things like students who support the resistance will have their visas revoked. So there's an attack on, you know, the intellect itself.
And Mohammed Okurd, you asked why Palestinians have to preface their support for the struggle against the occupation with some kind of statement distancing themselves from resistance actions like the attacks of October 7th of 2023. Why is this problematic? While supporters of Israel are never expected to decry the everyday violence of the occupation.
Because it's racist, because there's an impossible standard, there's an impossible demand made of the Palestinians to be, you know, for lack of a better expression, perfect victims, to portray themselves in this with this ethnocentric civility that adheres to Western guidelines. Otherwise, they would be deserving of death, they would be deserving of being bombed. And to reject this is to say that the Declaration of Human Rights is unconditional. And it's universal. And to reject this is to say that, you know, we believe in dignity. We don't believe in having to shrink ourselves or to perform a different script in order to be awarded freedom and dignity. It's these are things we are entitled to.
And I wanted to ask you about the slogan, from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free. This became a flashpoint. It's still a flashpoint in the United States for attacking pro-Palestinian groups for being anti-Semitic or anti-Israel. Yet many in the Israeli government, in the current Israeli government, actually support from the river to the sea as an Israeli state, and no one raises a fuss about it.
Yeah, of course, because the issue is not the statement itself. The issue is who says it. The Israelis could say from the river to the sea and more. They could say all kinds of explicitly genocidal statements. And yet, with us, they have to read between the lines. They have to infer and look for the hidden insidiousness in such chants. But it's comical, in my opinion, that we are being often interrogated about our chants, about what we say on social media. Meanwhile, when we talk about them, we're talking about bombs and airstrikes and burning people alive in their tents and hospital beds.
Mohammed, before we talk about your title, Perfect Victims, I just want to ask about your background, because we repeatedly interviewed you here and when you were in Sheikh Jarrah. And for people to understand that neighborhood and what happened there and the people involved being the leaders of Israel today, talk about the occupation of Sheikh Jarrah, what happened in your own home.
Yeah, I mean, the story of our home is as unique and absurd as it is common. This is a neighborhood where tax-exempt charities, registered United States settler organizations, Jewish American organizations, will come and claim our homes by divine decree, and they will exploit an already asymmetrical judiciary that is built by settlers for settlers to say your homes are ours, and we have the right to kick you out of them. And so I, like many, many Palestinians, grew up with quite literally an American settler in my house. And it's—
Wait a second. Now, you're 25 right now.
26.
Yeah. When was your home, were you forced to share it with someone who wasn't in your family?
It was about 2009. 2009, I came home from school and half of our house was gone. There was a settler inside it, a settler from Long Island. And, you know, right across the street from us, our neighbors, the Rawi family and the Hanun family, had lost the entirety of their home to settler organizations. And, you know, across the years, these settler organizations have gotten more and more funding. And like you said, their accomplices and people who work for them and people who lead these organizations have found their way increasingly to the government. But this is indicative of a larger—
They set up offices in Sheikh Jarrah.
Yeah, they set up offices in Sheikh Jarrah. They kind of use our homes as the home basis to build their electability, their popularity, because the Israeli public is really eager to see this kind of desperation, to see this kind of brutality, and it invokes a sense of safety in the Israeli public to see their politicians literally in the backyards of Palestinians saying, "We will take these homes. We will Judaize them. We will colonize them."
And your home today?
Well, my home today, like eight others, we have managed through a massive, massive global solidarity campaign to postpone the expulsion orders. But we still hang in the balance. We don't know what's going to happen in the next few years.
How does that fit into your title, Perfect Victims?
Well, I mean, to do a global campaign and to demand solidarity for our neighborhood, you know, we were told and we were taught to perform this role of to read the script of the perfect victim. So to tell you more, you know, I grew up as a child, as a 10-year-old, 11-year-old, we would have journalists, diplomats, all kinds of people visit our neighborhood as though it's some kind of zoo. And I remember constantly I would talk to them, I would show them, you know, photos of the brutality that the settlers were against us, and I would be pulled to the side by, you know, other concerned diplomats or journalists, and they would tell me, you shouldn't use this phrase, you should use that phrase. And it got into the point that even as a child, I would correct my grandmother when she would refer to the Jewish American settlers in our home as Jewish. I would say, no, don't mention that. But this kind of obfuscation, this kind of omission was kind of drilled into us. And then you grow up and you have internalized this entire framework of editorializing yourself, of curating yourself in a way that is non-offensive to the Western gaze. And then you begin to curate and editorialize all the people around you. You look at people who have suffered pager attacks in South Lebanon, people who have had their homes demolished in the Gaza Strip, and you think, what is the way I can make this victim, this young victim, non-offensive or compelling to a Western racist audience? When you, at some point, you have to liberate yourself from these shackles and say, actually, this is the victim. This is the person, this is the oppressed, not the oppressor, not the perpetrator. And we should shift our focus and scrutinize the perpetrators, the oppressors, the colonizers, the focal point and the root cause of all of the violence in Palestine, which is ultimately Zionism.
Mohammed, I want to ask you how Donald Trump's recent comments on Gaza tie into what's at the heart of your book. He's described Gaza as, quote, a big real estate site, and basically said that he doesn't believe Palestinians should be able to return once they've been removed.
I mean, ultimately, this so-called conflict has always been about the land, and any obfuscation of that fact is simply dishonest. Zionist greed has always been about Palestinian land. American interest in Palestine has been about keeping up a certain status quo, a military status quo in the Middle East, but it's also been about exploiting natural resources. I mean, Gaza is rich in natural gases, but what I think Donald Trump is doing is that he is dropping the script of the State Department, the official American script, and just saying things as they are without a filter. And that is helping people understand the long-term American project, because as disgusting and as abhorrent as Trump's comments were about creating property on the Gaza Strip, it would have never been possible had it been not for the Democratic Party and President Biden flattening Gaza and allowing the flattening of Gaza in the first place.
Can you talk about Shireen Abu Akleh as you talk about her in Perfect Victims, the renowned Al Jazeera journalist who was shot dead by an Israeli sniper, though she was wearing the helmet and the flak jacket. She was outside of the Jenini refugee camp. And how you feel she has been described?
I mean, I want to quote Palestinian scholar Urba Othman. She uses this phrase that Shireen Abu Akleh was killed twice. One, by, first time with the, by the Israelis, and the second time when we all started to refer to her as an American, you know. And we did this for a good cause. We had the best interest, the best intentions. We think that Americans will be exonerated, will be compelling in ways that Palestinians aren't, right? It's every day that a Palestinian journalist gets killed, but it's not every day that an American journalist gets killed. But when we refer to Shireen Abu Akleh as an American, we are not increasing her chances of justice, but in fact, we are divorcing her from the remainder of her people. We are exceptionalizing her from the very people that she was part and parcel of. And Shireen Abu Akleh was never a bystander. She was never silent. She was always on the side of justice. In 2002, during the Jenin massacre, she was digging with her bare hands in the rubble, helping mothers look for their children. This is not, you know, and this kind of paradigm that separates the journalists from the rest of their people is really like an outdated paradigm, I think, and it does a lot more harm than good. It doesn't humanize people. It actually exceptionalizes them. It transcends them into this kind of infallible status that nobody else and their peers can ascend to.
And I wanted to ask you, while so much attention has been focused on the Israeli wars in Gaza and in Lebanon, talk about what the situation is right now in the West Bank for Palestinians, and has it ever been at this crisis level in the past?
No, I mean it's horrifying what's happening in the occupied West Bank, and it's like you said, it has never been at this level of brutality. UNRWA reports that there's been 40,000 Palestinians displaced. We are seeing the Jenin refugee camp and other places in the West Bank bombed every single day. There are more and more martyrs. And we've heard, you know, many months ago that the Israelis, you know, gave the settlers 200,000 rifles, and you see these rifles while you're walking around the West Bank.
We're going to have to leave it there now, but we're going to do part two right afterwards and post it at democracynow.org. And I want to ask you about your dedication to Dr. Rafet Al-Arir, his body.
Fiber Plus Internet is now available in Sandpoint and King Cove. GCI offers high-speed internet in your community at the same plans and pricing as in Anchorage. More information is available at gci.com/internet.
Mr. Paganini, please play my rhapsody. And if you cannot play it, won't you sing it? And if you can't sing it, you simply have to swing it. I said swing it, oh, swing it, and don't ding it. Oh, Mr. Paganini, we breathlessly await your masterful baton, go on and sling it. And if you can't sling it, you simply have to swing it. I said swing it and scatter me far and